Hello and welcome to Conversations About Alcohol, a chance to step back from the coalface of general practice and learn from others on how to improve and inform our chats with patients about the harms of alcohol. For this episode on alcohol-related brain damage, ARBD, I met with a clinical psychologist and an acute medical consultant who've both worked together in Milestone, an inpatient service in Edinburgh for folk with ARBD. We discussed what it is, how it arises, who it tends to affect, and why we should start diagnosing and coding it in primary care, and why we should probably be talking about it as much as autism. The main point to emphasise is that it's likely, if someone can get sober, that they can reverse the damage caused by alcohol on their brain. And indeed, working at Milestone has given Dr. Gordon, a medical consultant used to seeing such patients bounce in and out of A&E, a completely new perspective. As we sat talking in the attractive building that used to be a hospital for AIDS patients, I couldn't help but wonder, will the need for ARBD beds ever become obsolete too? Dr. Stephen Smith and Dr. Claire Gordon, hello to you both.
Hello, hi. I am Dr. Stephen Smith. I'm a senior clinical psychologist. I've been working here at Milestone since 2017 as both a resident psychologist, and in the past couple of years I've led the Lothian ARBD training and resource team as well.
And Dr. Gordon.
Yeah, so I'm Claire Gordon. Some of you will know me already. I'm an acute medic actually at the Western General Hospital, and got into this role because one of my colleagues had recognised that patients with ARBD are generally unrecognised and take up a lot of bed dates in hospital without us really seeming to do much for them apart from try to sort out their social circumstances and turn them out again. And we felt that there was a better option for their future care. So I am a clinical lead here and mainly bring some medical knowledge and some bed management and some team management skills to the unit.
I'm actually particularly pleased to be here because I've got two patients right now who were discharged from Milestone last year. One in particular is doing really well. Apparently when she was first admitted here, she was so confused, you started the application for guardianship. And I'm pleased to be able to tell you as her GP that she's living an independent life, makes complete sense in our consults, and in fact, confused me that she had ARBD coded on her notes. So
wonderful. Here.
Yeah. You know, ARBD, although I've been a GP for almost 10 years now, is not something I had even really heard of until last year. Alcohol-related brain damage, it's actually an umbrella term for all the different ways that brains can be damaged by alcohol. Stephen, can you tell us a little bit about the term and how it's now becoming more acknowledged and what we should know about it?
Sure, I'll try, because as you say, it is an umbrella term and it covers a lot, and that's one of the problems, I guess, in defining exactly what it is. Mm. I think sometimes it gets confused as a diagnosis, but as you'll know, there isn't actually a diagnosis of ARBD. So what we're trying to do is identify people who have ARBD, and the criteria for that have been established for many years, and just very broadly speaking, we look at a history of over 5 years of heavy alcohol use. But when we say heavy, actually the criteria is 35 to 50 units a week. Mm. Which, yeah, I don't know how you about yourself, but that's not a huge amount when you think about it. Often the people that we see here in Penumbra Milestone have been drinking that at least in a day. But that's the sort of standard criteria. So a 5-year history of 35 to 50 units a week and alcohol use in the last 3 years, otherwise we can't say that this is definitely due to alcohol, and without any other identifiable cause or clear cause of the observed cognitive impairment. And the cognitive impairment in the early stages is often changes in problem solving and planning, executive functioning, essentially. And they can be quite subtle when you just see somebody occasionally. Often it's not easy at all to pick up, but family and friends and carers are often picking that up when we're not. As it progresses, we begin to see those marked deficits in immediate memory, so memory for things a few seconds ago or a couple of minutes, and delayed memory, 20 minutes up to, you know, a couple of days. Those deficits become more and more obvious, and it's often then that people get picked up. But it's hard to pick these things up, of course it is, which I think probably comes out in the data that we have on prevalence. We know the incidence is increasing because we're getting better at identifying it. And so in Scotland, it's really clear that there's a steep trajectory in people being identified as having ARBD. The prevalence, it's really difficult to pin down. Traditionally, we haven't been good at identifying it. We haven't been good at recording this data. Various studies over the years have suggested anything from between 0.1% of the general population up to 4% of it. The generally accepted one, the one that the Royal College of Psychiatrists used in their sort of main publication on this, was actually a post-mortem study conducted over five different countries, which came up eventually with a prevalence in the UK of about 1.5% of the general adult population.
And that was in the 90s, is that right? It's quite slightly old.
Yeah. This is using data from quite a long time ago, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's probably important to note as well that what they were looking for were signs of Wernicke-Korsakoff's in post-mortem brains. It wasn't ARBD. So 1.5% of the general population, that is a huge amount of people.
It is.
It's just that.
But that's still probably very conservative.
It's a very conservative
estimate. If I understand what you're saying.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
When you consider that the prevalence of autistic spectrum disorder, for example, is about 1.1%. In the UK, ADHD, roughly 2%.
Yeah.
We're talking more people have ARBD at a level which requires some level of support than people who have ASD or ADHD. And we all probably know people who have autistic spectrum disorder or ADHD. How many people do you know who are identified as having ARBD?
Yeah, this is such an interesting point because I'm sure lots of the clinicians listening, like me, are inundated with ASD and ADD referral requests, you know, every day of my clinical practice. And yet I think a lot of us are still completely unaware of ARBD. Dr. Gordon, you know, this umbrella term ARBD, there's quite a lot of different ways alcohol can damage our brain, including affecting our vascular supply, sheer trauma from accidents when inebriated, the direct toxic effect of alcohol on our brain cells, and thiamine deficiency. And I know that, you know, one thing we are aware of as GPs is that we should be prescribing thiamine for these patients. But of course, they're the very patients who are struggling. We're struggling to get them to take any of their drugs, let alone one tablet three times a day. Should we keep trying to get such patients to take thiamine? Does it make a difference?
So I think yes. I mean, it's not massively expensive. I think it's important that we try and get it into them, and it's a shame that it is less, is not effective just taking three tablets once in the morning. Like, it does need to be spread out because you don't absorb that much of it.
I wondered why is it three times a day?
You only absorb about 7 milligrams of the 100 milligrams anyway. So taking 300 milligrams, you're still only going to absorb 7 milligrams of it. But if you take it throughout the day, then you've got a more chance of getting some into you. So it does seem, and I have this conversation in the hospital quite a lot too, it does seem like a bit of a, you know, you're sort of fighting into the wind, but it is, I think it's worth doing. It can help protect their brains. Definitely when they come into hospital, I give them IV thiamine, even if they've got signs of Wernicke's, and they get high dose thiamine. But if it's just a bit of impairment or if they're coming in withdrawal, then I give them prophylactic just to try and get their stores up a bit if we can.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it is important. And I think it's really easy to get cynical and lose hope for the patients we come into contact with. And I think actually having hope that we can do something to protect their brains and, you know, tide them over till life gets a bit better sometimes, then, yeah, you know, we shouldn't be feeling things are futile in this group, I don't think.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the key point. You know, what I learned from you, Stephen, last year is the recovery rates really surprised me. You know, you really emphasised to me that if folk can stop drinking, their brains can potentially recover, which I really didn't realise that. I thought the damage was done. And I remember you telling me that, again, it's difficult to be able to give data on that recovery rate. And it's also impossible to predict who is going to recover. But actually getting the message out to ourselves, first of all, and then to patients and their families, that stopping alcohol can actually lead to recovery seems pretty key. And now that I've actually experienced it in my own patient, I'm suddenly on board with this.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. That message of recovery is so important. It's another artifact of historical research, historic research. The sort of standard approach for decades, really, goes back to a paper by Oslin, I think it was in 78 or thereabouts, who reckoned that 25% of people with, and again, this was related to Wernicke-Korsakoff's rather than ARBD, but it's been adopted by the ARBD research population, but reckoned that 25% of people would recover almost entirely, 25% a lot, 25% a bit, and 25% not at all. Now, that's just not true. And it was based, as I said, on data that didn't apply to ARBD. More importantly, perhaps, many of the people who are drinking to that level don't feel great about themselves and often consider themselves a failure and not worthwhile anyway. That depressive worthlessness is part of how they see themselves. So if you tell somebody you've got 25% chance of not recovering at all, it's not exactly going to motivate them.
No.
And often they'll put themselves in that category and say, well, what's the point? I'm not going to recover.
Yeah.
What we're seeing now in terms of recovery, and we can demonstrate, we have demonstrated this within Penumbra Milestone, in our 12-week programme, we can reliably demonstrate that people improve their cognitive function by about 10% in just 12 weeks. And that's across the board. Now, obviously, that's an average, but almost everybody who stops drinking begins to recover.
Wow.
You're absolutely right, Cassie. We can't say who is going to recover and how much. We're still looking at the research on that or the data on that and sort of hopeful that we might be able to pick up some indicators of recovery, but we don't have that yet. But so everybody begins to recover.
So the main message is recovery is possible.
It's more than possible. It's likely.
It's likely. That's good. And you see most recovery or most progress in the first few months, but you still see ongoing progress some years later. Would that be accurate to tell people?
Absolutely, yeah. So we can see that in the first 3 months of abstinence in particular, there's quite a steep recovery.
Okay.
But there's some really good research, longitudinal data, which demonstrates that people continue to recover with support and with abstinence. At least, the next sort of 6 months, there's a sort of gradual decline in the steepness of that recovery, but ongoing. And then up to 2 years, and people tend to plateau about there, but ongoing recovery has been demonstrated up to 5 years after stopping drinking.
So it's not inaccurate for me to tell patients that recovery is likely, and it's not giving false hope. It is actually scientifically true. If they were able to stop drinking, they could actually improve their brain function.
Absolutely, and quite quickly to begin with,
yeah,
with ongoing recovery, again,
yeah,
likely.
And have you seen that yourself, Dr. Gordon? Because I'm imagining you've seen a lot of folk come in and out of, you know, acute hospital in crisis. It all looks pretty hopeless. You never really get anywhere.
But now you're working somewhere like Milestone. Are you seeing a different side to things?
It's one of the most rewarding parts of my job, I have to say, because in acute medicine, we do see a lot of revolving doors with various different medical conditions. And working here has really opened my eyes to the fact that actually there is, there is hope, there is the opportunity for recovery. And, you know, there's a lot of residents that come to us and we're thinking about guardianship, and then actually things change, like we were discussing earlier, things change and actually they regain their capacity, they regain their insight, and suddenly their brains are able to see alcohol for, and the relationship with alcohol for what it is. And we do a lot of work then about relapse prevention, recovery work, coping skills, and feeding them into support for the future, which actually can really turn their lives around. So it's incredibly hopeful from that perspective. And you also, the interaction with families, I find really, again, just really hit me quite early on in when I started at Milestone, because a lot of families they're so fed up, they're so scunnered with trying to support this person who tries to stop drinking, and then 3 days later, you know, I've had people bring relatives into hospital and ask me to detain them to try and detox them. That doesn't work, and that's not a very good answer. But actually, over time, with weeks and with all the appropriate skills and interventions, you suddenly have families re-engaging and realizing that actually things might be different. And they will say, like, they're like a different person, or I've got my dad back, or my mom seems much, much better than she was. And that's really rewarding, because again, like I say, for years they will rarely have seen that side of their family member. And to sort of feel like actually they've got their relative back, and those relationships are re-established. You know, people see their grandchildren for the first time for years because their families have been ostracized quite often, is really, really rewarding. And just, yeah, quite often if we are going down the guardianship route, well, I'll put to my guardianship report that it should be reviewed within a year or two, because things change. Things is dynamic, and it's not, you know, there are residents that the guardianship can get rescinded because they've recovered enough.
Amazing. I mean, I think this is what we need to hear about in primary care, because we tend to see people when there are problems, and we don't see the people who recover. And I suppose also our patients are the family and friends of folk who are affected by addiction. So we're seeing a lot of the harms, but we're not necessarily seeing that recovery.
Absolutely. I was really cynical, I think, about alcohol, as many people working in hospitals are, before I started Milestone. Really cynical, like, you know, you give them the Pabernex and then you turf them out and they come back the next week. And actually it's really, really positive to see an intervention which, you know, it's not going to keep everyone sober forever, but it's also, I've learned a lot about alcohol and addiction, and also about, you know, people trip up, and if we can support them through that and get them back on the straight and narrow, and get rid of that sense of shame and failure that Stephen was talking about, in order to be able to get them back on the wagon. That's been really, really rewarding, really refreshing for me. I mean, my clinical knowledge and skills around alcohol are night and day compared to before I was started working here. And that's partly due to just working with so many professionals who see alcohol in a different way.
You mentioned about this kind of MDT type working. It's clearly a big part of the ethos here.
Yes, it's one of the things I think that one of the key things that makes this place work is that we have a weekly MDT. And we discuss all the residents with quite a nice time window. Like, we have 2 hours to discuss 10 residents, which for someone, I'm sure for you guys, and for someone working in acute care, is, you know, it's an unheard of amount of time to be able to really discuss things like their functioning, their families, their relapse prevention, their recovery journey, their social work. We have social work as part of the team, which is invaluable. Actually having a social worker in that's attached to the unit, you know, it makes discharge planning far less risky and far more likely to work. You address problems from day one. You liaise with family members from day one. We've got an occupational therapist. The physiotherapist does a couple of sessions a week. We've got, you know, recovery practitioners. We've got psychologists. We've got psychiatrists. And also the local GP practice provides primary care services to the unit, and they attend the MDT too. So we have a really really knowledgeable group of people who've all got quite a lot of experience. You know, Firhill have been our GPs for since we opened, so they know a lot about it as well.
Yeah.
And it's great to have all those brains around the room, but also all those hearts, if that doesn't sound too soft and dripping. But yeah, we all really care. We had a resident recently who's been a real challenge. He was here for over a year. And we got, I think, a good outcome for him eventually, but it was one of the most difficult cases that I've had. And the reason that he didn't just end up in a nursing home at the age of 64, going on 65, was because everyone cared so much about him getting the right outcome that we really did our level best to get him somewhere where he could be independent.
I mean, it seems like a terrific resource, one that I've only just discovered, but am I right in thinking that this is really the only residential rehab for ARBD in Scotland?
Yes, and Stephen may be able to know more about the national picture, but definitely we get quite a lot of people from interest from areas within Scotland, the UK, even Canada, the Netherlands, you know, because we are quite unique and there are very few of us, obviously there's residential rehab units, but not really focusing on ARBD. There's a lot of international interest as well. So it's...
You clearly do good work. We clearly need more of this, given the rates of alcohol harms in Scotland. And yet, I believe you still have to constantly fight for your cause.
Yes, I think one of the problems is that we're seen as a number on a spreadsheet. You know, we do have a cost. We have accommodation, we have staff. And the benefit of that is actually even not that difficult to show how much money we save.
Mm.
We can give them a figure too, but whenever people want to cut costs and save money, they look at things that aren't necessarily headline news.
Mm.
The last time they tried to threaten us was actually a time when alcohol was headline news, so that was quite well timed.
Yeah.
But you know, ARBD, like you say, is not that well known about.
No.
And usually, from my point of view, the way I was able to light that fire was around delayed discharges in hospital and recurrent admissions to hospital and hospital bed days. But it's hard to, we're continually having to justify our funding and the fact that actually this changes lives. I think I've worked out the maths. Our number needed to treat is actually more effective than stroke thrombolysis, stroke thrombectomy, PCI for heart attacks, in terms of value, quality of lives lived and impact on future health and to hospital readmissions, length of stay in hospital. Like, our data speaks for itself, but it's just not, it's not sexy, unfortunately.
No. And you know, you mentioned there your patient, you know, avoiding nursing home at the age of 64. And I know that, you know, the classic ARBD patient is your kind of older man, maybe 50s, 60s, who's been drinking for many years. But I think it is fair to say as well, Stephen, that although that you know, the majority of folk are older and are male, that's not the case completely, and we need to avoid sort of stereotypes. And that, I think Milestone has been seeing some younger and female patients as well. So just to sort of help us bear in mind that it's maybe not just your classic stereotype.
Yeah, obviously we all are very aware of the problems of stereotyping. We all try and avoid it, of course we do. It's something that perhaps isn't always in people's minds, and it's one of the messages we've tried to get out in the training. If you think back to what we're saying about the criteria for identification of ARBD, it's 5-year history of heavy alcohol use, but not extreme alcohol use, which means that somebody who starts binge drinking at the age of 17 could be showing signs of ARBD at the age of 22.
Mm.
And certainly within Milestone, we've seen the average age of referral drop. I think in the first 3 years that Milestone was open, average age was about 68.
Mm-hmm.
In the next sort of 3 or 4 year period, that dropped to about 64.
Mm-hmm.
The next 3 years, that's dropped to 62. And I'd be highly surprised if we're not under 69. Mm-hmm. We've been referred people who are 38. A couple of 42-year-olds.
Mm.
Now, this is in some ways a good thing because it means people are being identified earlier. And the earlier we can identify ARBD, the better able we are to help that person engage in the services. Because just thinking back to what we were saying about recovery, it's very hard for people with ARBD to engage in the services.
Yes.
Partly because they can't always remember to attend appointments, partly because their executive functioning is not working as we might want it to. So asking somebody, how will you solve this problem, when they can't solve that problem, is a really difficult thing.
Yeah.
So with that understanding that this may be, and that's always the message of the training that we do, what if? What if, as well as everything else, what if this is ARBD? What if this person has a cognitive impairment, which is impeding their ability to engage?
I really do see the value in that, actually, you know, especially maybe even in helping to explain to families, you know, that, you know, their loved one isn't necessarily just being difficult and impossible and uncaring towards them, but actually that their brain is literally affected and damaged by alcohol, and that is part of the picture here. I wonder if that helps families to understand ARBD. Do you think it does?
Certainly in the work that we've done, not just families, but professionals as well, just to have that understanding that says, this is a cognitive impairment. It's not personal. Sometimes it is, of course, and we can't take that away.
Yes.
But if we can understand that this isn't just the person being difficult,
yes,
or not willing to engage or not motivated to engage. That phrase really bothers me. There's a big difference between motivation and initiation. The ability to start doing something is an executive function. Motivation, mostly the people that we work with don't really want to be the way that they are.
Yes.
They're highly motivated to change.
Yes.
But there's things getting in the way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other big thing that I can see is just the lack of community services. You know, Milestone strikes me as a particularly good example, but GPs, we can't refer to you guys. My understanding is it's a tertiary referral from secondary care, is that right?
So we have evolved things over time. When it first opened up, then yes, because our money all came from acute. And over time, I started to get quite a lot of phone calls from people saying, this person needs to come to you. And I'm like, well, they're at home next to a bottle of vodka. That's not how we're going to be able to get them into our service. So we now have a bit more of a pathway that involves the Ritson Centre here, which does alcohol detox, because we can't detox people.
Right.
So there's now a bit of a pathway where people can be referred to the Ritson, and it, as part of that referral to the Ritson for 2 to 3 weeks, they might want to go to Milestone afterwards. Mm-hmm. There's definitely people I have on my radar, and I'm welcome to emails saying this person may need to come your way, or can I pick your brains about this, or how are we going to get this person in?
Yeah.
Because they do need to go somewhere safe for detox first, and we don't take people who are actively drinking.
Yeah.
And likewise, people get discharged from hospital to say, oh, they'll come to Milestone in 2 weeks' time when they've got a bed. We can't do that because the risk of them relapsing in between time is so high.
Yeah.
But I think we do have more of a pathway now involving the Ritson, and I, like I say, it helps me to know to have names, because I do have quite a good memory for names, and definitely within Edinburgh, if I see a patient coming into the Western or the Royal or St John's, I'll be like, ah, yes, I'll keep them on my radar. I'll put a wee note on track to say, please consider referring to Rob Milestone. I've heard about this person. It sounds like they need us.
Yeah.
And the patient generally needs to agree. We can take people who lack capacity, but if someone doesn't want to come to us, then they don't do well generally. Like,
yeah.
It's like almost everything regarding addiction.
Yeah.
But if they do get a chance to sober up and think about whether they want to do some recovery work and go on to rehab and just get a bit more time to have their lives kind of stabilise, then it's a great way of being able to swoop in and get people out of that, like I say, that revolving door we see.
So it kind of matters if we as GPs or practice nurses start sort of recognising and coding ARBD in the notes, then when a patient ends up in secondary care, that will be clear, and it might occur for onward referral. I mean, I'm just trying to see what will motivate us to start counting it. when we're still feeling a little bit like overwhelmed by what we're going to be able to offer.
But I think it helps the whole MDT. So definitely my occupational therapists and physios are like, oh, they want to learn more about ARBD. They now recognise it, and therefore they can, again, it's that, like Stephen was saying, that idea of planning for someone who doesn't have quite the executive function, and it's not just that their house is a tip and they're drinking. There's it's more complex than that. Mm-hmm. So I think it is helpful for the whole team assessing a patient when they come into hospital. And like I say, it's good for me to be able to see, oh no, this is clearly a diagnosis, because sometimes we get it for people who have got hepatic encephalopathy or who are just drunk. Mm. And actually they get better, they have a different trajectory, they may not want to come, they may not actually have ARBD at that point, but we can still get involved. And also I think it is that thing about, if you know someone's impaired, then you can get them onto IV thiamine, even if they're only going to be in hospital for a couple of days, giving them some IV thiamine to help protect their brains, because if it's not on their diagnosis list, the chances of them getting inappropriately treated for hypoglycemia without getting thiamine beforehand and precipitating Wernicke's, there are lots of other risks if it's not there as a diagnosis. Okay. Whereas if it is there as a diagnosis, we can hopefully get their treatment, even if they're not in hospital, they don't come to us. Yeah. We get their treatment a bit better.
So we don't need to worry that it's going to stigmatise our patients if we put ARBD on their notes and they end up in hospital. We could be confident that it's more going to lead to appropriate care.
I think that's a really important point, Cassie, because it does still carry a stigma.
Mm.
And it's one of those, if you don't understand what it is, then you'll assume what it is. One of the things that we've been trying to do over the past couple of years with the training team is sort of what Claire was saying there, not just help or encourage people to identify it, but then to know that there is a staff group, a staff team, the frontline staff workers who know how to work with ARBD. Going back to the numbers that we were talking about earlier, the prevalence rate is so high that we will be seeing people with ARBD in every service.
Mm.
And it's just not sensible nor fair to ask people in primary care, GPs, to take all of that burden.
Mm.
What we'll try to do, and there's some research from Wales, University of South Wales, have been at the forefront of research in ARBD, and they've demonstrated, and we've now sort of replicated that by training frontline staff in identification, understanding, and working with people with ARBD, it changes attitudes,
okay.
It destigmatizes, and we don't have the data yet, but it's likely to produce better outcomes for each individual.
Yeah.
So that identification should lead to greater understanding and people going, all right, I know how to work with this. I know that I have to write things down for this person.
Mm-hmm.
I know that if they don't turn up for an appointment, it's not because they're not engaging.
Yeah.
Or not necessarily.
Yeah.
How do we work with that? And again, that's not just on the GP. That is for all frontline staff.
Yeah.
So the more we can get that message out there, the more staff we can train. And we trained something like 1,200 people,
okay.
In the Lothians over the past 18 months.
Okay.
Frontline staff, third sector workers, hospital staff, just for that point, just to say,
yeah.
That you can recognise this. It does make a difference.
Yeah.
It's not a stigma because we can work with it, and we can work with it.
And there's hope, because if someone
stops
drinking, they can recover.
And by identifying it, by working with it, we can... We can be better at helping people stop drinking, because we know that's hard.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
I'm wondering if we're at the bit, where we have to start counting something to then get it recognised before more services will then be allocated to it. And, I think a nice place to end would be to ask you both what your hopes are, for the future regarding ARBD. We're now in August 2025. What would you realistically like to hope for in Scotland regarding ARBD? Would you want more residential rehab centres like Milestone, where we are today? Would you like somehow more community outreach? What would be your hopes for the future?
My from my point of view, it needs a bit of both. So having our future no longer threatened, and having another couple of units across Scotland would probably make a difference, because we know there's a lot of demand out there, you know, particularly in Glasgow, and then you've got the north as well. I think community teams, I mean, that's where a lot of it's at, because it's not just one of the issues with residential rehab units is that you are cut off from the realities of life in here. Like, it is quite difficult to drink when you're a milestone. It's not impossible, but it is like but it is quite difficult. And you do breathalyze residents, and they do sign a contract to say they're not going to drink. But at home, you have none of that. So actually, the community teams are really important, because, like I say, you know, recovery is not linear. People will trip up and fall, and and being able to support people through that and support families, I think, is hugely valuable. And like Stephen was saying, a lot of it is about upskilling people who work in the community. I mean, I think if you'd asked me last year, I'd be like, well, it sounds like the youngsters are no longer drinking. It'll be fine. There will be no ARBD in 50 years' time. I think their numbers have shown a reversal on that. But, you know, I hope the minimum unit pricing makes an impact. You know, I hope ultimately... I would like people to drink less overall, so that ARBD isn't an issue. Yeah. Just as I like people to smoke less, and that makes my life in the hospital a bit easier.
Yeah.
You know, we need to address the deprivation and addiction and the reasons why people turn to things to numb out the world outside. You know, you see that every day.
Yeah.
So I'd like Scotland to have a better overall health and less of a need for units like Milestone. Like, if they wanted to close Milestone because they didn't need us, I'd be delighted, as opposed to them just not having enough money for us.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I get that whole need for community support afterwards, but I do think for the patient I have in mind, coming in here and staying here and... escaping her marriage and her domestic situation, which was the driver for her alcohol, was actually the turnaround moment for her. So I can see how inpatient residential is still part of the picture.
I'm just going to quickly come in on that. Because I think, like you say, we give them a period of stability, we give them clothes and food. I think that resident came to us with a pair of hospital pants, and that's it.
Wow.
So, and she'd been in hospital for quite a while.
Yeah.
So clothes, food, care, non-judgment.
Yeah.
All those things. So one of the measures that Penumbra do is called an IROC, and it's about sort of self-worth and a number of different parameters about how you function in your life with your environment, health, socially. And again, that's one of the factors that I really like, because it gives people, you do see people's self-worth go from I'm rock bottom, I'm scum. Like, a lot of people say to me, I don't deserve to be here, I don't deserve to be taking up a hospital bed, I don't deserve to be in a unit for this. And you see them by the end having that idea of, actually, I'm entitled to be here, I can offer things to society. So get them, you know, involved with volunteer work. They suddenly have a sense of self-worth and purpose and what they can go back to society. And like you say, I think that's really hard to do if someone's still got a really chaotic lifestyle, they've still got their friends next door trying to get them out to go for a drink. You know, they've got a lot of people who, there'll always be people that don't want them to do well. They want them to fail, because that makes other people feel better.
Yeah. What about you, Stephen? What are you hoping for ARBD in Scotland, realistically? I ruined it by adding realistically.
Well, I think it is realistic. I absolutely agree with everything that Claire just said. I think she put that wonderfully well. For me, I think it's sort of threefold, perhaps. People with ARBD are some of the most disadvantaged people in our society. And the services that we have for them at the moment are utterly inadequate. And again, that means a lot of the burden is on primary care. So what I would like, firstly, and it is realistic, is for Penumbra Milestone to not only continue to exist, but to grow. We know that we could fill more beds.
Yeah.
We know there are more people just in Lothian who would hugely benefit from the service that Penumbra Milestone provides. And as Claire said earlier, we can demonstrate the cost efficiency of that. I think replicating that across the country, because this is just the Lothians, and we could fill 20 beds at a time, probably, without batting an eyelid.
Yeah.
So that would be the first one. This residential rehabilitation model to be picked up and replicated across Scotland. The second is the training issue, the raising awareness, almost at a public health level.
Yeah.
Because the more we can recognise that this is a problem, the more we can do early. It's that early intervention thing, again, which goes for so many things. And I know there's a lot to keep in mind.
Yeah.
But this costs such, or causes such damage to personal lives, to society, that it seems to me neglectful not to consider this. And the third thing, which goes with those two, and we've touched on it before, is that message of hope. Recovery is not just possible, but likely. But we have to help people to engage with the services that are going to do that. Mm-hmm. And people with ARVD find it particularly difficult and therefore are particularly disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
But people do recover.
And that's a perfect way to end. Thank you both for your time and for your energy today. And it's been really helpful to clarify a lot, but also to just really emphasise that message of recovery being possible.
Thank you for listening to Conversations About Alcohol. Be sure to follow and like the podcast to be updated when new episodes are released.